history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there that really ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their memories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. You know, there's really no limit to what we can learn. So yes, we're educated. We're also entertained. And so often we leave inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. As our country and our world continue to be gripped by this coronavirus pandemic, this is a week with two major holidays marking miraculous comebacks to overcome what looked like certain defeat. And I know we're all hoping and praying that that's exactly what we're going to see here in 2020. And as we gather physically or digitally for those holidays of Passover and Easter this week, let's remember our men and women in uniform who are marking those moments all over the world. 75 years ago, there were Americans giving their lives for our freedom on those holidays. And I thought we'd start by hearing how those holidays were marked in the European and Pacific theaters in the final year of World War II. More than 550,000 Jewish Americans served in our armed forces during World War II, and one of them gave me a call this week from Las Vegas. Selwyn Dante wanted to update me on his story with the fact that he was recently honored by the French government with their highest award. He can now wear a medal signifying that he is a Chevalier in the Legion of Honor, a reflection of France's gratitude for his role in its liberation 75 years ago. His service with the 638th Tank Destroyer Battalion in Europe would include the chance to visit a liberated concentration camp and witness some of the inhumane treatment that Jews and other prisoners of the Nazis had faced. Before that experience, though, this 18-year-old from Louisiana had a chance to mark Passover in a wartime setting.
I attended the first Pesach service in Europe. We did it in Belgium. All the troops, anywhere in that vicinity. 1st, 3rd, 9th Army, and British 2nd Army had several hundred of us, Jewish people, to attend that Seder service in Belgium.
Is Passover something that you had celebrated back home?
Always.
Every year?
Every year.
So your whole life, Passover is a significant thing?
Absolutely.
You fast, you read the story of Moses and the Israelites in Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big deal. But that Passover, 1945, with 1,000 other soldiers who were fighting this war against an enemy that wants to exterminate the Jews. What
was
that like?
That had great significance because that was the first Passover that they had had in, I guess, 5 or 6 years before anybody had Passover.
The significance of the words you read and the ceremonies that you carry out, did it take on greater meaning there?
Well, my grandfather was a part-time rabbi. He took on the religious responsibilities of all of Southeast Arkansas. Mm. They didn't have a rabbi, so he was an acting rabbi. But I've been from a religious family for all my life.
And I'm sure that you'd always been able to imagine what Moses and all of these Israelites in captivity in Egypt,
yes,
were thinking when the original Passover happened. But to be there in a war zone, knowing that your life is at stake and all these 1,000 Jewish soldiers with you, their lives are at stake. What went through your mind as you participated in these same things you'd done your whole life in a very different setting?
I've got to that point where I wasn't scared. Just accepted things of what they were. I was so happy to be able to celebrate Passover. It's a very important holiday. I'm a strong believer in the Jewish faith. It's never going to be eliminated completely. It's not possible. Don't care what they say. They can all hem and haw about it. But you cannot kill all the Jews on earth. Even though we're a small minority of the billions of people here we have, you're just not going to be able to get rid of us. I don't think the Lord will let it.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. If in that moment, as not even a 19-year-old yet, you're still 18 years old, celebrating Passover, knowing that those people thousands of years ago were spared, is there a real belief?
That never entered my mind at all then. I'm more interested in seeing about the war ending and us getting rid of those damn Nazis. I didn't even think about that at all. I know it'd be a lot to consider that way, but it never entered my mind to think about that. All I want to do is complete the job of getting rid of the Nazis.
And he would help complete that job. That was Selwyn Dante. And right after he marked Passover in Europe 75 years ago, millions of servicemen and women observed the Easter holiday. In the Pacific, another teenager named George Chrisman was about to experience his first taste of combat at the Battle of Okinawa with Navy Beach Party Team 62.
Easter Sunday, we climbed out of the cargo ship, lounged the cargo nets, loaded ourselves onto the Amtraks because they weren't sure what the beach was when you get into the beach with the ship. So we went on the Amtraks. We gathered out. It was still dark. Gathered around a big circle. We had Easter sunrise service there with the chaplain. And after the chaplain had the Easter sunrise service, we left for the beach. And about that time, my commander, the beach master, had his radio, and all the big ships started shelling the beach where we were going to land to clear it further. And then as soon as we got near the beach, stopped that shelling, and the Amtrak continued on. The Army went ashore. About the third wave, we went ashore, dug our foxholes, set up the radio communications and beach markers, and started unloading ships. Very scary.
I would imagine so, and a pretty important role in that invasion. But you said the first thing you guys did was you had an Easter sunrise service. The
right.
Chaplain led the way with that. Do you remember anything about what was said there or what that meant to you to start that day that way?
Nope. Just scary.
Yeah. I imagine you felt like you were going to need some extra protection.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And so you talk about the beachmaster and this landing party. So basically your guy's job was to get there first and set up some kind of organization so all these waves and waves and waves of troops coming ashore would be organized and going in the right direction.
Right.
Is that right?
The beachmaster's job is to direct that landing.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a pretty dangerous job, too, though.
Well, yes, it is.
Did you guys come under enemy fire?
Yes. We had a lot of Japanese up there in the mountains that were shooting at us.
Uh-huh. So what did you do?
Duck.
You had a foxhole and you...
Yeah, but the foxhole was only about a foot deep.
That doesn't do much good.
Because you had hard pan.
Uh-huh.
So you dug whatever you could and you lay down in there, and then it rained and we got full of water and... Didn't worry about the water, just get down in there.
So what goes through your mind when you're in that foxhole and you still hear these rounds going off around you?
Hope you live for the next day. And when that first day, we looked up there and it was a little house about, 50 yards or 100 yards away. They were flying the Japanese flag.
Mm-hmm.
So about three of us went up there, and first we called in for an American flag to be sent in. They sent the flag in. When we got the flag, we went over took the flagpole down. It's one of those flagpoles where you pull a pin out and the whole pole comes down.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the flag down. We put the American flag up and put the flag back, pole back up. And that little house that was there, we didn't know it at the time, but there was a guy up on the roof was shooting at people. So eventually, after we had the American flag up, we went up there with a couple of hand grenades and blew up the whole building. And he was down on the ground, dead. No,
but you didn't know he was there when you were taking the flag.
No.
He could have killed you.
Oh, yeah. And then after I took the flag down, I put the flag in my pocket. You got those jumbo pockets, and I put it in my pocket. When I got back on the ship 4 days later, I still had this flag.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home, I put it in my treasure chest, and my daughter was going through my stuff for 4 or 5 years. Well, it's been about 10 years now. And she found this flag. Said, "What's this flag, Dad?" And I told her. I said, "That's the one we took off a flagpole in Okinawa." And so I folded it up and put it away, and I still got the flag now.
And I imagine there were a few American servicemen, whether they were Navy like you or Army or Marines or even Army Air Corps, that ended up on Okinawa, because that was a long, drawn-out battle over a lot of territory. There are probably quite a few of them that ended up bringing a flag of some kind back. But my guess is yours might be the first one. Could anyone have grabbed the flag on Okinawa before you did?
Any one of the three that took it down. I cut it off because it was tied onto the pole.
Yes, but so there were three of you, but there was only one flag.
Right.
So you got that flag, and I'm just saying timeline-wise, because this is the first day of the battle, and you're in there early on, you were probably the first American to take a Japanese flag on Okinawa.
Right.
What was the significance of that for you, to cut down this Japanese flag, not just to take it for yourself, but to put up in its place the Stars and Stripes?
That was amazing. A lot of memories go by there. I look back at that flag and salute it and say, "Oh, there's my flag.
Mm-hmm.
It's our country."
And there was a long way to go in that battle.
Oh, yes. 10,000 a day were being killed.
And you'd be back on the ship for most of it.
Yeah.
But you did see some. So the first day on Okinawa, you're one of the first in. You take this flag. Still the Japanese are firing on you guys. How long did that day feel?
Seemed like it never ended.
Yeah?
Especially about dusk. When it got dusk, it was about 50 Japanese planes coming over. Those kamikaze pilots. Oh, they just blackened the sky. And here they come, and you just jump in your and dive into your foxhole. And these planes, terrible noise. They couldn't get any planes off because it was just about dusk. And they didn't get any planes off. So all the ships at sea were firing.
So you have a pretty good seat for this show.
Yeah.
The ships are close enough to shore that you can see them.
Oh, yeah.
And you see the kamikazes attacking them. Is that a bit of a helpless feeling? Or do you find yourself cheering?
Nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Just pray that you don't get hit.
Yeah, and pray those guys out on the ships are safe.
Because they've got some of those planes were hitting right near the beach, blowing up.
Mm-hmm. Did you lose any friends that day?
No. Luckily, we were on the beach, and the Army was moving ahead.
Uh-huh.
We had friends that got shot, but that's about it.
Uh-huh.
I got hit one time in my hand, but that's a small shell. You know, a small arm, so...
It was that day, or
reach down, yeah. Reach down, pull it out with your teeth, because it burns. Burns like it's on fire.
Okay. You're saying that like it's not a big deal, but the rest of us, for the most part, have not been in these kind of situations. So you're 18 years old. You're on the beach on the first day of one of the biggest battles in the history of the world, and a bullet hits you?
Yep. You're scared.
So you're trying to direct troops who are still coming into shore?
Yeah, and call for whatever supplies they needed.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a pretty chaotic scene. It's probably just go, go, go.
It is go, go, go. You don't sleep for 3-4 days.
Literally.
You're up all night long calling the radio, and you might nap, but that's about it.
As troops come ashore, they keep moving inland, but you're staying there to keep things moving and coordinate what's happening. But in that job, you're on the radio, and did you know people were shooting at you, or did you just feel it out of nowhere?
You could hear them.
You could hear guns going off.
Yeah, the Japanese are... They had the cliff up there. It was mountains. And they had dug in big shoulders up on the cliffs. And they had trails. And they packed the dead bodies. They packed in front as a guard.
Uh-huh.
So they were looking over the dead bodies. And we ended up going up there and with hand grenades and sneaking up there and throwing the hand grenade in the cave that they had built so it would be, wouldn't be any more small arm fire.
But before that, you actually get hit in the hand.
Yeah. We didn't worry about that.
Well,
just a small one.
Well, what did it feel like? How did you realize what had happened?
It just burned like somebody hit you with a hot coals.
And you look down at your hand, and what do you see?
It was right here in the wrist.
Your left wrist.
You just reach in there, and nothing else to grab, and so you bite on it, spit it out, and burn your lips. And you do what you have to.
I'm sorry I'm laughing. I'm picturing this, and again... You're talking about this so mundanely, like this is something that just happens. But you have a bullet that lodges in your wrist, a hot piece of metal.
Yeah.
And you took your teeth and bit in and got it out of there.
Yeah.
You'd never done that before.
Nope. We've been trained, though, for first-line medics because there's no doctors on there.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody gets shot or a shrapnel or whatever, you can do a minor incision and take it out. If they break a bone, you feel with it.
Like uh-huh. And
you find out what's the matter, and then you tape it up. Most of those guys were, I don't care. I'm going to go on. Get me well, and I'm going. My job is to fight. Give me my rifle.
So you'd been trained to render first aid if people were injured around you. But is that how you were trained to do it, to bite a bullet out of somebody?
No, you just do what you have to.
So when it hits you, you go ahead and you clamp down on the bullet and pull it out of there and spit it out naturally. Didn't think about saving it for your kids?
Nope.
You weren't thinking about ever being married or having kids at that point.
Saving your life. Your life is more important. Get it out of there.
So what did it look like after you took the bullet out of there? I imagine there's some blood, right?
Yeah, there was blood. It was sore. You push it back together as much as you can and put a bandage over it.
Uh-huh. You had to do that all by yourself?
Yeah. Put a little sulfaformaldehyde in it and bandage it up.
Well, just the fact that you got hit in the wrist... That's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I think later it's pretty close to the old heart, but it's only a small arms, you know, like a .22 bullet.
Well,
so if it hits a bone, it's going to just smush her. It's not going to be like a big .30-30 rifles that the Army was using.
Well, still, if it's in the right spot.
Oh, yeah.
That could be it for you.
The neck, the head.
Yeah. So you said you were scared before that happened.
And you're scared after.
More scared?
Oh, yeah.
And you have to keep doing your job.
You do your job.
And you said you guys didn't sleep that whole 4 days you were there?
You nap once in a while, but the minute you go to sleep, there's something going on, blowing up someplace.
How did you do that? What do you think happened inside of you to enable you to carry out those duties, to stay awake, to keep fighting, to doing whatever you were doing?
Just the flow of adrenaline.
Yeah?
Just keeps you moving.
I'm imagining you had never experienced anything quite like that before.
Nope. No. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah. So what were those ensuing days like?
Oh, they tapered off a little bit when the Army kept further in, and the airplanes quit flying over.
Uh-huh.
So it got better, got a little easier to take.
Was it more challenging in the dark than it was during the daytime?
No, more challenging in the daytime.
Why?
You had more Amtraks coming ashore. Amtraks coming back with somebody that's been shot, and all they want to do is get that bullet out or get that shrapnel out or whatever it is, and then go on. They don't even want to give you their name and their number. I'd get their name and number and turn it over to their officer so their officer could make sure that they followed up with the medics, that they didn't get any kind of infection or whatever, and got properly treated like in a hospital station. And then they put on their record that they'd gotten shot, you know.
Right. So you're helping people go in to battle in advance, but you've also got them coming back wounded. You're processing them. You got them coming and going.
Yeah.
You're a pretty busy guy.
Well, there's not that many.
Were you helping with first aid for some of them too, or
yes,
only yourself? Okay. So you had to help patch up some other guys.
We had a basic medical training.
Uh-huh.
Where we could do minor incisions and stuff like that. We had a kit there. You had to sharpen your knives and everything. It's not like the knives today are disposable.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sharpen them.
Can you give us an example of some of the things you had to do in caring for those wounded soldiers who came back?
Well, one tank driver had gotten off his tank, and he'd gone ashore kind of looking around to see where he was going to go, and he stepped on a landmine. It blew his heel. The whole heel just opened up in his shoe. The heel part just opened up, and he come back, and he'd got him back on the tank some way, and he came back, and he wanted to see what he could do, so he got off, and we looked at it, and it just peeled off, like your sole on your shoe would just peel off. And I opened it up and took the tongue depressors and scraped it out, whatever's in there, in the blood and stuff. And then I put butterfly bandages. We had to make our own because they didn't have them. We made them out of tape, put that all around it, had to cut his shoe off to start with, and then taped his foot up with an ace bandage. And I said, why don't you just lay down here and we'll get somebody to take you back to the ship. I'm from a farm up in Oregon, he said. I don't need all that kind of stuff. He says, just get me back on my tank. So he climbed back on the tank, and away he went.
Wow.
And I had his name and his number, and I gave that to his officer, and so they checked it later. Then about, almost been 40 years later, I was up in Oregon, in Yahats, Oregon, where they have a big campground-like. My wife's uncle was there, and we went walking to get the mail. And here comes some guy down the road limping, you know, kind of limping, walking away. He's older than I was. He was probably in his 80s by then. Come limping around, he looks at me, and he's about 100 yards away. But he still sees me, and I hear this guy cussing at me. You SOB, you're the one SOB. And my uncle says, what's this? Are we going to get involved in something? I said, I don't know who it is. And I got closer, and he says, you're the SOB that fixed my foot. And so I had to go up and meet his wife, and she was crying. You saved my husband's foot. He said, if it hadn't been for you, he'd have lost his foot. Mm-hmm. I said, well, we do what we have to.
How fulfilling was that for you to see him again and understand how much it meant
good
to him?
It tears my eyes.
I believe it. It's bringing a little water to your eyes right now.
Yep.
Yeah, and probably a few people out there listening. So that's an example. Really, you're kind of a jack of all trades there on this beach in Okinawa.
Well, I've been lucky.
Uh-huh.
The good Lord blessed me with the ability to do a lot of things.
We're overdue for our first break, but when we come back, more memories from what was happening 75 years ago this week. A very dangerous week for anyone near Okinawa. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you during a time when everything seems a little different in light of this coronavirus pandemic. Some of the most encouraging news in the midst of all the tragic developments has come from our World War II vets when we hear that they've been able to overcome this awful virus. Like Army vet Bill Lapshees, who recovered from COVID-19 and got to celebrate his 104th birthday this week in Oregon. In light of these coronavirus concerns, I'm not currently able to go out and meet with veterans in person. Over the years, we've done a few of these interviews over the phone when necessary, but it's always better in person. It sounds better. I know it's easier for a veteran to trust someone sitting right in front of them. So as I've put these in-person visits on pause for a while, it's created another opportunity to look at some 75th anniversaries. And in digging back through our archives, I was really struck by how many vets we've met over the years who survived kamikaze attacks at Okinawa. There were other heroics during that 82-day battle that we've heard about, and in addition to what happened, sometimes it's just as interesting and eye-opening to hear about what almost happened but didn't. Those moments that left so many veterans feeling, as my grandfather was fond of saying, that they were living on borrowed time. Such was the case 75 years ago this week on the historic Coast Guard cutter Roger B. Taney for a 21-year-old from Oklahoma by the name of Jim Kitchen.
In Okinawa, I guess it's just one time, it was nighttime. We'd been at general quarters several times, but we had left Okinawa and go to these, there was a few miles over, it was a lot of little islands there, kind of protected, to get supplies, and a Japanese fighter plane came through the harbor, and he must have done a barrel roll, and just the sound of the engines made my knees get weak.
Where were you on the ship when this was happening?
Oh, I was sitting back on the aft deck just looking around.
So you saw this Japanese plane and...
No, it was dark and you couldn't see it. It just made the noise. This is at nighttime.
So you heard it and that got your attention a little bit.
Just the roar of the engines when they like to do a barrel roll. And it just, I don't know what it did, but never fired a shot or dropped a bomb.
But that wasn't the only time there was a plane headed toward your ship. Okinawa is infamous for the amount of kamikazes in and around that battle. And your ship became a target for one of them?
Yes, we had a plane come in. It was raining, and he came in, and he's coming down our starboard side, and we started shooting at him all the way around, and he got to the port side, broadside to us, and I was the trainer on the gun. I run the gun fore and aft, you know.
Yeah, explain to us how that works. Most people listening have never been on a ship with a gun like this. It takes more than one person to make this gun work and actually have it do what it's supposed to do.
There is a trainer and a pointer, and the trainer runs the gun around, and the pointer up and down, and he pulls the trigger. And then we have ammunition handlers, and then we have projectile and a hot shellman. He catches the brass container when it comes out and throws it away.
And how big are these projectiles?
It's called a 5-inch 38. The projectiles are 5 inches, and they're about 16 inches long, and I'd say the powder can was about 30 inches, so it did make quite a noise.
Yeah, quite a noise, pretty heavy to handle, and obviously can do a fair amount of damage. So you said you're the trainer on this gun, so it's your job to aim this gun side to side.
That is correct, and there's pointers. It's coming from radar that we have to follow. It's kind of fun to do it. If the ship is rolling, you learn just to roll with the waves and keep it there.
Yeah, easier said than done. So, but I imagine it gets pretty tense. I mean, firing that gun in practice is one thing, but when there's a plane heading your way, that could crash into your ship and do a whole lot of damage, then this isn't fun and games anymore. Do you remember how that all happened, what it felt like, and how it unfolded?
Well, you know, we were just young kids. There were so many of them that were picking out the larger ships. I saw 9 ships get kamikazes in one day. We were hoping that they'd get close enough that we could shoot at them. But if we did, we had to help the gunner's mates clean the gun up, the barrel, wash it out, oil it.
And can you maybe help us understand how difficult this is with the plane moving that fast at the altitude where it is, with, you know, having to have this teamwork on the gun, how difficult it was to actually shoot one of these guys down?
Well, it was just luck, because radar tells you how fast they're going and the altitude they're going. And for a plane to be coming down about, say, 300 miles an hour, and you're going to put a projectile in that gun and set the fuse setting that it will go off whatever you set it for, like 2 seconds, 2,000 feet. And with a plane coming down, and then the time that you get all that information and put it in, and it explodes right in front of him, and he rolls over and crashes into the water. It's just, how do you do it?
And you kind of stated that like it's a hypothetical, but that's what actually happened. That's what you guys were able to do to take out that kamikaze.
That is correct. Okay, I'll tell you what I said then. When I stopped moving the gun, and I just sitting still, I knew something was wrong. I looked up and I saw the plane coming down on us, and the pointer was Tex. And I said, Tex, if you ain't had the pointers matched, get them matched, because he's coming in. And the gunnery officer must have heard me. It was an open mount gun, and he was kind of standing behind me. So he went around and put that 2-second fuse setting on it. And when that one went off, it exploded right in front of the plane, and it crashed in the water 1,000 feet behind us.
What do you think would have happened if that fuse hadn't been set like that, if it hadn't, if the points hadn't been matched up, if it didn't explode right when and where it did?
Well, if it hadn't, it looked like he was looking down our gun barrel, and I wouldn't be here today. But I don't know, the ammunition handlers, they got scared and run forward, but I sat there, and I don't know, I didn't. But when I saw the explosion in front of him, I sure felt good, though.
I don't want to exaggerate here, but it sure sounds like you're saying for you guys to put that shell right there and have it explode right there was a bit of a needle in the haystack. And if you hadn't found that needle in a haystack, then you all would have been dead.
That is correct. I feel that way. We wouldn't be here right now talking.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic or get you to say anything that you don't really feel. But when you think about that moment, because that's significant to me, and I've interviewed so many veterans who have moments like that, how do you account for that, the fact that it happened just that way and you're still here talking to me right now?
Well, you know, I never thought about it after I went home, and I haven't talked about it much until here, just the later years that we've had so many reunions with my shipmates, got together and got to talking and realized what really happened.
So you guys shot down a kamikaze, but that wasn't the only thing that was shot down by your ship. And sometimes it was hard to know who was coming at you. You guys actually shot down an American plane, is that right?
Yes. It came over the island the same way as the first kamikaze that we shot down, and they wouldn't identify themselves. So after they got in over the ships that were anchored in there, we shot him down. After we shot that one down, then a two-motor Betty bomber was coming in just over the water real close, and it got within 1,000 feet of us before the forward guns knocked it down, and it cleaned the deck of a freighter 1,000 feet in front of us. We had a pretty good gun crew, because when we making those trips to North Africa, they sent us up on the east coast there a little ways, and we would have gunnery practice, and the planes would drive fly a sleeve by, and we'd shoot at it. And they got unhappy with us, because every time they come by, we shot it down. They had to go back and get another one.
Let's get back to that American plane you shot down. Were you guys able to determine whether that was actually an American crew on that plane, or that maybe it was Japanese soldiers who had stolen an American plane?
Well, the only thing that they could find out, that there was no planes missing on any airstrips or aircraft carriers, and so they just were very sure then it was a stolen plane that they captured on one of the islands and and they came over and they couldn't identify themselves.
Well, and those must have been some tense moments because they had a chance to identify themselves, and I'm sure everybody on ship is hoping they will because you don't want to be firing at a plane with American markings.
I was watching as it came over the land, and it got to the ships, and it got past a few of them, and still wouldn't identify themselves, and so that's when the ship took action, the forward guns, and before it got very far.
Don't hear a story like that every day, do you? That was Coast Guard veteran Jim Kitchen remembering some of his close calls at Okinawa. For Wyoming native Bob Ashburn, he hadn't quite reached his 20th birthday, but he'd already survived 8 invasions. With enough close calls to earn his ship, the destroyer escort USS Tisdale, the nickname Lucky T.
My gut tied up in a knot. Some guys showed stuff outwardly, and boy, they're smoking cigarettes. I never smoked, but they were just puffing on those cigarettes. I don't know what they're getting out of it. I never showed anything outwardly, but my gut was tied up in knots from nerves, I guess.
When the kamikazes came, can you paint a picture for us? Can you tell us what you saw?
Basically, they were after those carriers. I could show you some numbers in here. You know, we're not talking about, like, I hear about these few strikes they're doing over in the Mideast. We're talking about several hundred planes a day. Now, the fleet is broke up into so many pieces. Like, let's say when we was working with carriers, there'd be 6 carriers and about, 15, 18 escort ships all the way around them. The reason for that, whenever they decided to launch into the wind, they had protection no matter which way you turned. The closest one, I thought, and I'll back up. But this was the one that really... This guy was coming on to us from astern. That's the least way we could get any firepower going. And we're back there standing up. Here's your depth charge racks and there's 2 guys here. And that bunker was coming in on us. We're probably going to get it. But about maximum 50 yards away, that guy was still coming down on us and strafing us. And you look up there and you see on his wings just sparks coming off. Looks like sparks coming off there, but and of course that's to, try and knock down our guys. When you see that, and about 50 yards away, I said, oh boy, he was coming head on into us. But we got a direct hit, must have hit on his bomb, because that plane just blew up and throwing, parts of it, splashing all around us, but he didn't make it there. Then other times, they were pretty close. How we could see there, when you see those sparks coming off their wings, then when you go out and you're hitting them, and you're hitting, some aluminum with this bullet, it's like little white puffs of smoke coming off. When they get in that close, they're getting on you. But as this fleet is, here's this bunch, and there's that bunch, and that, a few miles apart. But whichever one they picked on, that's the one that caught the worst. You're just hoping they'd pick on somebody else. Now, the next thing, a lot of people don't kind of know either, the kamikazes, they were one chirp. They just went and that was it. But then in these same raids, they'd had their regular Air Force, their bombers, torpedoes. They did their thing and turned around and went back. We're talking hundreds a day. So when I hear about these little airstrikes back in the Far East, it's peanuts. We had hundreds of raids. But there's one time there, we were at general quarters for 40 solid hours. They're trying to get you, and you're trying to stop them.
Can't imagine what that feels like. I mean, there's got to be part of you that says, there's no way I'm going to make it through this.
Well, at Okinawa, almost constantly. There were so damn many of them, and they just kept coming. They had 2,500 planes, lost just to Okinawa. And you get 2,500 planes, your odds get... We just kept thinking, because we lost half of our squadron. We thought, when the hell are we going to be next? But we lucked out.
The Lucky T. And you told us about one of those times where you were very fortunate with that kamikaze coming straight at you. He's strafing you. And you said 50 yards away, he blows up because one of your guns hit him?
Yes. On this size ship, the biggest gun was a 3-inch. It had to be a hit from this one aft gun that was shooting back. Now, see, over on the sides of them, they could have the 20s and the 40s pound them, but to blow them up like they did, we figured he had to hit the bomb because, it just blew up. Hey, and enough, close enough, got slapped in the face from the concussion. When it's like that, it's pretty damn close.
So you felt it. When it exploded, you felt that.
Oh, yeah. It's like slapping you like that.
So a few questions here. A, if that gunner doesn't hit that plane, what would have happened?
It would have wiped out that whole, see, the K guns, four on each side, and then that first, see, that gunner got him, he was one deck up, but it would have wiped them out too. Hard telling how far, but see, that kind of a ship can't take bad damage.
Would you be here? Would you be sitting here talking to me if that guy hadn't shot him down?
No.
What if they had shot him up, but not blown him up? In other words, hit him, disable him, but not explode him.
He would have still went in. Because, see, that was the deal. They knew they was going to get shot at. If they're strafing or anything they're doing, didn't do anything. Because when that plane comes down, say the bomb goes off, the plane crashing into you, and then that gasoline burning. So it's...
Well, I don't want to exaggerate, but I'm just listening to you recount this story. And it sounds to me that shot that gunner had on him was kind of a one in a million shot. If he hits him anywhere else on that plane, you're not here.
Yes, most definite. After this is over, us guys back there talk. We says, hey, that was it. We thought, bad. And you go through that day after day.
Well, let me ask you this, because I've heard a lot of different perspectives on this. When you go through something like that, when you live through that and you realize how close you were and how nearly impossible it was for your life to be spared in that moment, yet it still happened, do you feel like someone was looking out for you? Was there someone there protecting you?
I said my prayers every night, and I've said the same prayer ever since. It was just by the grace of God we made it. That's all I can figure. Here are these buddy ships, they're getting wiped out. And you just say, well, we lucked out that time. Lucky to you.
Navy veteran Bob Ashburn remembering his close calls off of Okinawa. It's time for another break, but more similar stories to come as we keep that time machine dialed in at 75 years ago this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Effler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As families across our country mark Passover and Easter this week, we heard about what those holidays were like in a war setting 75 years ago, and we've heard more about what was unfolding at Okinawa 75 years ago this week. We've heard from four different veterans from four different states, and now we'll make that five for five as we listen to the memories of Benny Noonkester, who was a 17-year-old in charge of the Commodore's barge on the attack transport USS Chilton 75 years ago this week.
The first day there, I remember I looked up, and here come a plane down, straight down, not on an angle, and got a destroyer right near us and killed nearly everybody on there. And it didn't actually sink, but I don't know why it didn't. And that was my experience the first day.
So first day of the battle, you see a kamikaze take out a destroyer, and that kind of says, uh-oh,
Yeah, it did. Then after that was every day. We had 44 separate attacks in one day. The one time there was like 400 planes come in one time. All in 53 days, day and night.
So that's pretty much a constant fear that this could happen.
Yeah, it was. That was day and night in that 40 of them, because they come in at night also. And you just lose so much sleep till you got where you didn't even care. I mean, it didn't seem to bother you. During that time, I would see with the Commodore, we had to be prepared to take him where he needs to be taken. So whatever we'd be on standby, not have a permanent station, and we'd be handing ammunition or filling in someplace. And that's what I was doing at that time. Then later when I became a gunner, when I was out at sea, that would be a different story. I could have a permanent station. But usually in them situations, in case I could take over somebody else.
Is it safe to say that those 53 days at Okinawa were the most intense 53 days of your life?
Yes, I would say that. I grew up real fast. I know we hear more about Iwo Jima, it was sad, but Okinawa did have a lot more casualties, I think you'd combine them all together, be 270,000 lives lost, not counting wounded.
And nearly 5,000 from the Navy alone were killed at Okinawa.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was the biggest loss for the Navy in the history of the Navy there. We got hit by a kamikaze, and I thought that was it. This was in the evening of April the 2nd, and I was way down in our compartment, which is the bottom of the ship, and all at once there's this big explosion. At that time, you went up on starboard and down on port. There's 50 of us down there maybe. We got out of there okay. And I was wanting to get topside. I don't know where we're sinking or what have you. And one day, I'll just tell you about a good buddy of mine. I went through the gallery, and he had been up on the bridge, and he was all soaked with water and everything, and he had done lost it. He was plumb gone. I mean, he was so scared. He was, and I talked to him a little bit, and I hadn't seen daylight yet. I want to get out of where I don't know where we're going down or what. And I finally had to leave him. And he just went over in a corner and got down in the fetal position. He couldn't help himself or nothing. If we went down, he'd have went down. And I went up topside, and now scattered around on the deck was pieces of bodies and planes all over the deck. I'm standing there because this day I'm just a standby. I look over at our sister ship, which is the Henrico, the APA 45. It just got hit, and it was burning dead in the water and killed lots and lots of sailors. I looked up, and here come these. This days we got hit with bombers called Francis, not fighters, but they were bombers. I looked up, here come a bomber off over our port side, and it was just getting ready to come down on us because it wasn't flying very high. And all at once that plane was coming, and it made a turn. And I looked up at the belly of that plane, and it went out and got our escort. Just blew, instead of us, it got that. And I mean, I just turned around and looked up to straight ahead, and about 5 degrees off of the starboard side, I seen another plane coming in. And it was maybe 200 feet above the water. I waited there, and I waited so long, I said, well, now this is it. I'm not going to survive this. It's too close. Can't shoot it down. So I just jumped back down the deck, down in the galley, made about one step down jumped. And waited for it to happen. Thought that was it. It didn't blow, and I went topside, and they got it with a 5-inch on. And I found out 55 years later, talked to the guy who put sights on that thing and got it. And so we shot that one down. Then, another minute went by, and I looked over on the starboard side coming straight in was another bomber. And it was I was just trying to guess the distance from us. If I said 300 yards, I mean, it's coming 200 miles an hour maybe. And it's just ready to make it to hit us. And we shot the left wing off. And it just stalled in the air. And I looked at that pilot. I don't know where he shoved that window forward or backward and jumped out. Just jumped out in the ocean before it hit, before it crashed. And it hit right at the edge of our ship. And... So anyhow, that was that one day, but there's a lot of other ones.
So I mean, as I hear you describing this, I'm just trying to picture it in my mind, and it almost seems like these Japanese planes, which are not trying to bomb you, they're trying to crash into you and take you out, that they're just swarming around like flies or something.
They did bomb us first. I mean, this one had hit us. I don't know why he dropped two 500-pound bombs, just missed us. If he had kept them bombs, we'd have probably went down. And the way I understand what happened there, if you take weight out of a plane, it'd naturally go up, and it hit us high, you know, instead of down maybe where he really wanted to hit us. We'll never know why that happened. But.
Well, I bet you have your theories on why and how, and it sounds like each one of those you thought could have been it, was probably going to have been it, and none of them were it. Why do you think that is?
Well, I just give God the credit there myself, personally. I really do. I'm standing there, and now I'm looking up, and here's a guy out of my division. I'm just like in a graveyard. I mean, there's I don't know where anybody's at. And I see him walk out and kick that machine gun off that plane, was laying there on the deck just the other side of me, and he kicked it over the side, one of the machine guns I had on there.
And you said that was just one day? So there are other days that maybe weren't quite as intense, but were like that?
Yeah, they was. I mean, they was, I'd say every day there was it was something, not that bad, but I mean, they was getting, hitting ships around us, and I don't know why we did survive.
What was the severity of the damage to your ship, and do you have any sense for the casualties that those kamikaze attacks caused?
Well, you know, it didn't. We got to run back to States right quick and got repairs done and so forth, and wasn't that bad. They reports, I can show you in a little bit, where the write up Tokyo Rose wrote up that they sunk us with no survivors. I've got that here.
But you're here to say that's not true. That was a false report.
Yeah, that's a false. That's false. She wasn't very honest.
That much we know with certainty now. It describes there the pieces of the plane going into the sea and being scattered across the deck. You've got proof of that right here in your house. You have a little piece of that Japanese airplane that struck your ship?
Yeah, yes, I do. It's got Japanese numbers or writing on it. I don't know what it means. And I had a lot of other pieces, and I don't know what happened to it.
There is a Pulitzer Prize-winning war correspondent, very famous at the time, named Ernie Pyle. How did you and your ship come in contact with Ernie Pyle? And was that a big deal to you all at the time? Because you had a Commodore on your ship who was in charge of 30 ships. Was Ernie Pyle a big deal to you guys?
Yes, he was. He was really a guy that you talk to, the common sailor, you know, and he didn't really hobnob with the officers as much as he did maybe the enlisted men. And, yeah, he was a fine guy. On the Commodore's barge, there was just four sailors, and the day of invasion of Aishima, we took him and his party over to the island, and he got killed within minutes when we dropped him off. And it was only like a bluff. There was no buildings, or he was like 100 miles from anywhere where we dropped him off. And I remember that very well.
You took the Commodore's barge and dropped him off. When did you hear that he had been killed?
I think that evening, because he got killed maybe a little before noon. I'm not sure. But news spread real fast, you know, about it. I had patrol duty that night, all night, on there, just off the island. And I don't know, I never will know what happened. The ship dropped us off and just left us. And I thought, you know, this, they didn't come back to get us, even the next day. So I don't know where what they had in mind there. But anyhow, we finally went down to the coast of Okinawa and found our ship and got back safely. If you're traveling across country sometimes, if you're four of you, somebody would say, look, a couple of you guys better sleep because you're going to have to drive after a while. So the boat's coxswain said, a couple of you guys better lay down and go to sleep. Well, how are you going to go to sleep? They're shooting. The artillery's going over. I mean, all this explosions and everything. And it just got dark. So me and another sailor just laid down in the boat, and it was so dark you couldn't see nothing. And all at once, I looked at the edge of the boat, and here comes up some fingers inside the boat, and then he pulled his head up. And the only reason I could see that the moon was directly behind him, and I could almost touch him. And then I hollered, and he just dropped back in the water, and it's dark. Nobody slept all night.
So these are our Japanese divers.
Yeah, our job was to shoot them, because we had some LSTs and so forth shooting rockets out there, and then they'd swim out maybe and blow them up, you know, with explosives. And our job was to intercept them and shoot them. If he got our boat, he could have been, you know, no telling what he could have done. I never did really think I was going to get killed, but except that one time, I just knew that was it. But I definitely wasn't in a position I was ready to go, because I wasn't.
And obviously, we're all thankful these courageous young men lived to tell those stories to help the rest of us understand. That's what they were up against 75 years ago this week. How does that compare to what you and I are facing today? Surely there must be some perspective for us to acquire there. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us today on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.